Mark My Words shares Mark Homer's contrarian views on investing, business, finance, economics, and all things money. Mark interviews the world's most successful business, finance, and money experts, as well as imparting his knowledge in a factual, direct, and no-nonsense manner. Welcome to Mark My Words. And here is your host, Mark Homer.
Hi, it's Ron Moore here. Welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast, and I've hijacked the Mark My Words podcast. We regularly get asked for Mark and I to be kind of put together. We're off doing different things, often in different parts of the world nowadays. So I'm really excited to be bringing Mark to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast. And Mark's brought me to the Mark My Words podcast. And in this special episode, the joint episode, really what we're going to do is really get into Mark's head, and maybe a bit from me as well, about business, finance, investing, you know, what we stand for, what we stand against, some of the things Mark loves about business and life, some of the things he hates and, you know, wants to see change. So it's going to be kind of like a, almost like a behind the scenes conversation that Mark might and I might have if we're upstairs in our office. So Mark, this is everyone, this is Mark. If you don't know Mark, because you subscribe to The Disruptive Entrepreneur, Mark's been my business partner now for 11 years. Most things I know about money and finance and business have either come from Mark's brain, or he's got me down a path so I can be down the right path to learn the right strategies. Definitely, if it weren't for Mark, then I probably still would have been painting at 2 a.m. listening to German heavy metal. So my life has definitely been transformed for the positive through being business partners with Mark. Mark, how many properties have we got now that we've bought, sold, own, manage in total? Well,
we manage about 700 tenants. Got to be, I don't know, over 550 properties, units, something like that. Yeah. We've bought, sold, you know, have invested in over the years easily that number.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, still doing it. Yeah. Still buying them, still keeping them.
Yeah.
Yeah, love doing it.
So you've been doing property now about 14 years, because I think you had about 3 years already experience before we met, something like that.
Yeah. So I got into this market 02, 03. Started investing abroad.
So 15 years.
Yeah, 02, 03, yeah. Started investing abroad and then started buying and refurbing and then remortgaging. You know, when I met you, local terraces, you know, that's what really got me started on this journey, probably.
The but ugly ones.
The but ugly ones probably started in 05 and that's what, you know, what really worked and what we really grew.
Still got the same passion for property 15 years on?
I absolutely love property, probably to the same extent. However, I love doing different things. If I still had to buy the same terraces and do all the stuff that we did back then, I think my passion would have waned a little bit.
Yeah.
So I've moved through the cycle to different types of deals, to bigger buildings, to buildings with more income and a better use of my time.
So something I know you're really big into is not chopping and changing every 5 minutes. And I think you've stumbled upon something there that I think is really important to share. So you've talked about doing the same thing, property, but keeping yourself interested over the years. Because if you did single lets for 15 years, it sounds like you'd get bored. But of course, if you changed strategy every 5 minutes, it sounds like you wouldn't be able to get compounding and results. So how do you balance staying in the same business model for a long time and keeping yourself interested?
For me, it's about creating that nebula. So you've got a circle of knowledge or a sphere of knowledge. And that might be property investment. And you might be good at, you know, buying stuff, increasing the density, increasing the rent that comes out of it, and then leveraging it. Yeah. And really, that's what I've become good at over the years.
Yeah.
So buying stuff cheap, adding quite a lot of value to it, and then obtaining really good leverage to get most, if not all, of the money back. So that's something that I've focused on and just kind of dragged out across lots of different mediums. So that might have started with, you know, smaller properties, and then that's built up to, you know, a valuation I'm doing this afternoon would be for a 38 bedroom HMO split across a load of units. That'll be somewhere around 2.3 million in terms of value once it's done. So, you know, I've tried to use the knowledge I've got and go one or two steps removed, but not go chopping and changing into a completely different area.
Yeah.
You know, yes, invest in stocks. Yes, might do some other passive type stuff. But, you know, that's secondary. And I don't spend that much time on it.
Yeah.
core strategy is buying, investment, you know, mostly residential property. There is some commercial in there as well. But I certainly don't like flitting around stuff that I don't know anything about, that's a long way away from my sphere of knowledge.
Yeah, I think you taught me a lot about that, because before I met you, I really needed a load of variety in my life. And I was probably quite opposite to you in that regard. So, you know, I'd done 3 martial arts, got 3 black belts. I'd got good at cricket, good at golf. I'd done my art. I'd been a pub landlord. I did an architecture degree. I mean, I was the guy that tried everything. And I got quite good at some things, but never great. And that was always one of my regrets. And then when I met you, you were almost the opposite, in that it'd be a massive decision for you to change. Whereas for me, it'd be a massive decision for me to do the same thing. And so I think what you taught me is you can get your variety doing niches within your main thing. And I think that's what you're saying you've done. So property's your main thing. You're not going on to the coffee business, which we'd probably love to do in a different world, or some other business, but you're doing commercial, conversion, single lets, HMOs, maybe the odd test of service accommodation. So you've got this sort of overarching thing that you're going to always do for the rest of your life, but you're making your variety by doing different sub niches within that niche. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. And I think that originally it came from my dad. My dad used to watch things on TV. I remember, and a TV presenter 1 month would be presenting about property. And then 3 months later, they'd be doing a holiday show.
Right, yeah.
And he'd kind of look at me and go, how the hell does he know anything about holidays when he was doing property 3 months ago? Mm. You know, and you see it with politicians. This is a favourite one for me. You see politicians, you know, they're an MP, and then they become the Secretary for Health. Now, of course, we know below them there are all these civil servants that should be, you know, well experienced and doing something for a long time. But then there's a reshuffle, and, you know, the Secretary for Health suddenly becomes the Home Secretary and deals with, you know, law, order, justice, you know, in prisons.
Yeah.
And, you know, they haven't really got any experience in that. And you see some of the resulting decision making and the, you know, the stuff that flows from that. So
Trump got into power, though.
Trump did get into power.
And not a politician.
And he got into power probably based on, you know, what he made people believe, a certain segment of the population.
Yeah.
And, you know, by putting all this kind of rhetoric out. I'd also say someone like Trump is going to have to spend the first 6 months actually learning how that job works, and how, you know, all the wheels of government move, because I don't think he's got a clue. And I think he's a perfect example of somebody who obviously knows a lot about business but doesn't understand the inner workings of government, because he's never been there.
So it's important for you to be seen, and logistically and operationally in business, to have a core knowledge that you can get really deep at and that people know you for.
Yeah, I think that's really important, because I think that's how you add the value. And you know, the theory's good and the theory's important, but it's that experience, that stuff that adds, you know, adds up over time, that goes into your subconscious, that gives you the gut feeling each time you're presenting with something new, or presented with a deal, or presented with, you know, some numbers. And, you know, all of that knowledge which you build up, the experience which goes into your subconscious, and you can suddenly make a quick judgment on, known as gut feel,
and it's right.
Yeah, and it, you know, having a good result that comes from having experience in a sphere for many, many years.
Yeah,
if you're darting about all the time,
because that's one of your pet hates, isn't it? Either people or being forced to chop and change and flit and, you know, new thing every 5 minutes. It's, you just,
this is probably upbringing as well, isn't it? You know, I don't know. I'd see that as flaky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, because you've been in business since you were, what, 17?
Yeah, I had little businesses since I was probably, 16, something like that.
That's 20 years. Yeah.
And, you know, I was importing cars, and I'd be doing stuff on the internet and, you know, bringing, you know, different products in and stuff like that. So they were different types of businesses.
Yeah. And can I just jump in? The thing is, if you, in the last 20 years, have done loads of different things, you couldn't bring that experience of 20 years ago into what you do now, because it wouldn't be relevant. You know, if you'd have done martial arts for 2 years, and then you'd have done holiday repping for 2 years, and then whatever, but the stuff you learned when you were 17, bringing cars over from Ireland or whatever, that you can, that experience lends itself now to what you do or could do, doesn't it?
It does do, because it's, you know, it's transactional, it's commerce, it's dealing with, you know, certain taxes.
Sales.
And imports, and sales, and, you know, working out margin and profit. So there is some transferable knowledge which comes with that. Yeah.
So people listening, like if people are starting a business or property or something like that, one of the common dangers of their results is they're jumping strategies every 5 minutes. And obviously we see that, you know, you call it the course junkie or whatever. And I was definitely like that before. What advice, word of warning, whatever, would you say to someone who's seen the new shiny thing? They've only been doing the previous shiny thing for a few months. What would you say to them?
Spend a few months getting really, really good at your core strategy. And fine, it might not be for you. It might not be your flow. It might not be what you love and therefore what you're going to be really good at. But you need to have a good 6 months, year pounding away at it to give it a chance to show its face.
Yeah.
You know, most of the results that come from all the work which you put in, you know, they may take a few years to show themselves.
Yeah.
And if you're flitting about trying something new all the time, you're never going to give it long enough to work out whether that thing was going to work for you. And you probably end up with no results. A lot of people, I find, they start, they get halfway, 60%, 70% of the way through, start to kind of have questions in their mind about whether it's going to work and, you know, is this right? And, you know, should I be doing something else? And then maybe about 80% of the way along, but they switch.
Yeah, and they can't see they're that far down. Otherwise,
no,
they wouldn't. Yeah.
Exactly. They you know, and they look at other people and they say, oh, he's really successful. He was born that way or whatever. But actually, all of those people went through the same thing as well. They had years and years and years of, you know, maybe no success or average success. And then actually it was probably in the mid to latter years where the success, all that work and all that time and all that experience really started to come forward and show the results started to come up.
Yeah. A lot of people in life are looking for fairness. I don't really believe in fairness. I believe in merit. You know, you get what you earn. We all get our dose of luck and how we use our dose of luck. Because, you know, I've been lucky meeting you, for example. But we all get our dose of luck and it's how we use it. But in a way, going into a strategy is kind of not fair because when you start, you have to do all the work for none of the results. That's kind of not fair. At the end, you get all the results for not much of the work, and it's not fair. And I think if people can get sort of fairness out of their head and just think merit and stay in the course, I think they'd probably stick at things a bit longer. What do you think about that? And this entitlement sort of age we're in at the moment.
Yeah, well, they talk about it being specifically prevalent. And those, well, I've seen a few people say those born in the 80s or the 90s or the millennials.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was born in 1980, so, you know, I'm probably in that category. But, I do see more of that today. You know, you see it with tenants, you see it with people who are in your business, employees. There is certainly more of an entitlement culture. I don't know if that's the you know, TV, the media, society in general. But you
more relaxed parenting.
Yeah, more relaxed parenting could be it as well. You know, we're certainly a lot softer on our kids. And maybe that's right in some way. But, you know, going to a tough school and, you know, being worked really hard all day. I watched a thing last night on, you know, kids in South Korea. And, you know, those guys, I'm not saying this is necessarily right, but they start at six.
But they work like nutters.
They start at six. Yeah. And they go on, you know, through to, I don't know, well, whatever time in the afternoon. They have a bit of a break. And then they go to after school club. It goes on till midnight.
Yeah.
So they're six till midnight every day learning.
Is this what your son is going to be doing?
You know, they gave them this this GCSE maths paper to complete. And, you know, these guys are not, you know, they're not GCSE. They haven't studied for GCSEs. And they're a bit younger than that as well. And all these South Korean kids finished them, and the majority of their class, when they were asked, is it really easy? They all put their hand up and said, yeah, it's really easy. And the consensus was that that was kind of primary level maths for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, there were two or three English children in there in the class, and they were having to do the same thing. They were pretty much half asleep.
Yeah.
They couldn't handle it. They found it really tough. And I think that's, you know, it's not genetics. It's not, you know, English kids are, you know, any worse than, you know, South Korean kids. They've just had a load more discipline drilled into them from an early age. So they find it normal. And they don't find it as hard to perform at that level because they've been drilled. You know, our kids, they go through their early teens and into their teens and, you know, maybe it's an easier life and a softer life. And it's probably more like that in America as well. Therefore, when it does get tough, it's harder for them.
They give up because they're used to giving up and they're used to having someone who supports them.
Yeah.
Oh, don't worry about that. You can do
the state, you know, the welfare system, whatever it is, the society that we live in, you know, that's what it's taught them to do.
Yeah. And how do you change that? You know, you're at some point, maybe soon, who knows, might become a dad. How do you get into people the stickability? You know, because you and I both know, we talk about this a lot. If what you're doing now, you're doing in 20 years, no matter how bad and how slow you were to do and how many mistakes you make, in 20 years, you're just going to be...
Got to be good.
By default of everyone else giving up. Mm. So how do you drill that into someone?
Well, I think maybe with kids, you probably give them a reward, but you make them stick the course. So, you know, they only get the reward if they do X, Y, and Z and hit the result. Yeah. And, you know, at the risk of sounding sexist, I'm the male here, so, you know, I'll just say it. You know, if mum says, oh, well, he tried and, you know, therefore he can have X, Y, and Z, well, the answer's no. You know, he gets the thing, yeah, or she gets the thing when they've achieved the results. So they become more results focused.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean, you know, you need to be berating them or be really hard on them. My dad was pretty hard on me, but, you know, I think... you know, if they can get a lot more than the other kids by doing a lot more, then I think there's a lot of benefit there. I think sending them to the right school has got to be the right thing.
Yeah.
Putting them in a peer group that is very focused on results, you know, and very interested in achieving, I think is probably the biggest thing, because their peers are probably going to have the same, if not more influence than the parents.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's going to push them on. And I know for my kids, and certainly what you're doing with your kids, Rob, put them in a very high achieving school, and it's tough. I know Bobby comes home very tired, you know, and maybe that'll be the case for the first few years, but it will just train his brain to be so much more focused, and he'll find it easier as he goes along.
Well, I made a decision at least 3 years before Bobby was born. He was going to go to the best school I could find. And I made sure I saved up all of his school fees until he was 18 before he was born, because I just thought that's going to make the biggest difference. And, you know, like, who knows? I'm not saying it's the be-all and end-all, but yeah, I agree with that. Okay, so what about someone who's an adult and they're finding themselves a bit flighty? Because let's be honest, society, I don't want to sound like an old fire, but I probably am going to, but society and generation is a bit different now. You know, you're on Facebook, you're on Tinder, you're just, you know, if a video is more than 2 minutes, you've lost your concentration and everything's more instant. And so our attention span has gone really mad. I've noticed with you and I over the years with our iPhones, we're freaking addicted to these things. So how do we, you know, what can we say to people to get them back into the longevity thinking and the enduring the challenges and the not giving up when it gets slightly hard, but someone who's not a child, who's already, you know, their personality's already formed?
I think they need to focus on the result and probably make some public, you know, announcements and tell those around them what they're doing and what they're going to achieve by when. Mm. You know, somebody getting into this game, maybe they're buying property or they're investing or whatever, it might be difficult, you know, if they tell their family they're doing this, or their friends, they may be a little bit negative because they don't want them to push ahead. So not everyone would want to do this, but certainly those around them who are, you know, in this game or a little bit more positive about it, if they say, well, this is what I'm doing, I'm doing single lets and I'm going to buy X number by this stage, you set a date and, you know, you put pictures up and you burn it into your brain and you set reminders, I think that's got to be one of the best ways, because if you don't stick to it, A, other people are probably going to think you're flaky and therefore you might not feel great about that. And I think B, you're just going to be a lot, it's going to be a lot clearer to you what your goal is and, you know, what you need to achieve at the end of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And people are going to be asking you, what are you doing with this? What are you doing with that? You know?
Yeah.
I think if you're changing every 6 months or every year, then whoever it is going to be saying, oh, well, you were doing this 6 months ago, you were doing that. And that's a classical sign that somebody's not achieving if they keep flittering around and changing.
Yeah.
It is to me anyway. And I'd say most people in a, you know, who are successful in business, if they see somebody chopping and changing a lot, moving around different business types or careers or whatever.
You can't trust them, can you?
No, it just shows that they...
That's what they're going
to
do.
They're going to continue to do that, A, and B, they haven't made a success of anything yet.
Yeah. Well, you know, each time we were interviewing someone today for a high-level role, and each time you and I see a CV that's got a job every year, they've got to fight really hard to it's hardly ever we get anyone in. And I think longevity is one of the biggest signs of a successful person. Mm. Okay, so Mark, I've had the pleasurable experience and the challenging experience of being involved with you writing your two books. Challenging in the drawing out 50,000 words has been a challenge, although we've been in great countries doing it. Okay, so Mark, I've got my rather small iPad here. I asked you before the podcast,
yeah,
some of the things you love and some of the things you hate.
Yeah.
So you hate swapping and changing, we've covered. You hate investment on a whim. Talk about that then.
Yeah, so for me, I think all investments need to be tested and measured, okay? And, you know, rather than just being, in my early days, I'd probably be relatively negative about. And, you know, I'd see it and I'm saying, wow, we haven't done that before. We've not tested it, therefore not interested in it, cast it aside. And that probably, you know, I probably wouldn't do most opportunities that I'm presented with now, because there's so many more opportunities than I've got time to deal with anyway.
Yeah.
But of course, there are loads of things which are just one step removed from our core strategies, which work really, really well and which you can make a lot of money from. But it isn't necessarily what we're doing. And yeah, they've been referred to me by people I trust and like, and you know, they look good. But the only way in the end to work out if they work in our business with us, you know, and are in my flow and your flow, is to try them over a period of time. Now, testing and measuring involves doing one or two and effectively proving concept.
Yeah.
So you might have a new kind of investment type. Maybe it's serviced accommodation. So you do one and you maybe test it over a 6-month period. I get all the data, you know, make sure, you know, I understood it backwards, forwards, and then maybe do another and then roll it out.
What you're saying, instead of doing none and never doing anything new, or 15 all at once, you're essentially de-risking going into a new model.
Yeah, because I see a lot of people, you know, see something new and go and do 15 before they've tested and measured.
Yeah, because they're all excited.
They're all excited, and then they make the same mistake 15 times on about 10 different things, and it ends up costing them quite a lot of money, or they don't make such a lot of money.
Yeah.
Whereas when you really understand the model and you've done it well, then when you multiply it up over a lot of units or a bigger investment, then you tend to do really well and get greater returns.
Yeah.
And of course, the flip side, if you're just, you know, negative to anything new, well, the first thing is obviously you'll lose quite a lot of opportunities. You know, the opportunity cost of that is quite high. And the second thing is it's quite important to have one eye on new stuff, because the existing business you're in at the moment, although it won't change that much, people always want to live in houses, things will change. And if you stay exactly how you are today and your business stays exactly how it is and you do exactly the same things, you will eventually die.
Yeah, we've seen it in property, Sale and Rent Back, those that didn't adjust from that, and then Mortgage Express, those that didn't adjust from that, they seem to be massive and then they just disappear off the face of the earth.
And then you had the credit crunch, you had to adjust from that, and now we've got the landlord tax changes, which are, you know, people are moving into a limited company, and of course the new FCA rules on rent stress, and you know how mortgages are probably going to be less in terms of loan to value to individuals moving forward.
Yeah.
So people need to adapt and people need to move their strategy, and maybe they were doing single lets, but you know, maybe they move more into HMOs or into other strategies as well. As do I think it's the death of single let? No, I don't. I think that's nonsense. And I think that's what people said, you know, when the credit crunch came along, when the end of Mortgage Express was nigh, you know, and prior to that, when rent backs stopped, or, you know, when you couldn't basically rent somebody's property back to them. So all of those things mean you've got to change, move, not necessarily pivot completely, but just move the trajectory of the strategy slightly.
Yeah.
To make sure your business model still works.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean you have to reinvent the whole thing. And that is
you. Well, you like evolution, not revolution,
absolutely,
don't you? You like Porsche, not Ferrari.
Evolution rather than revolution is certainly, you know, the way in which I work.
And I think the way you balance this, because the thing I've had to learn over the years is trying to curb my desire for variety in business, but also feed my desire for variety in business. You can't change who you are. And so I think what I've learned to do is you have your main thing. So I created this model 70-20-10, which is based on what you taught me in the early years. So let's say property single lets is your main thing. You do that for 70% of your time. and you do that for 70% of your time, all day, every day, until it completely gets disrupted and doesn't work anymore. But then you spend 20% of your time, or your evenings, or your weekends, that's when you play around and test your new stuff. So it's almost like you've got incubating this new stuff, so that as your main thing changes over time, and it'll change slowly, you've got this thing on the background which isn't taking your day-to-day out, and then as things change, you can bring this more in. You know, for us, like, we were buying single lets, and then I, you know, started writing our first book, and then we did our first course, and for years we were doing way more property buying than we were courses, and now it must be, well, most of your time's still buying, but most of my time's in the education business. Had we not spent a bit of my time writing books evenings and weekends, and had we not done the odd weekend course, we wouldn't have grown into that. Mm. So you can almost have a strategy, can't you, of where you're doing your main thing most of the time, but you can have your creative variety outlet evenings, weekends, or in ring-fenced amount of time.
I think that is, you know, that 70-20-10 model which you came up with is often the way I put it. You absolutely need to have one eye on what else is going on, but don't just jump into that new thing. A, before it's tried and tested, preferably by a few other people first.
You love doing that,
usually,
don't you?
I usually wait until...
You always let me go first.
I usually wait until two or three other people who I, you know, respect and have time for, you know, are doing something and have told me that the thing works, then...
So that's vicarious testing.
Vicarious testing. Stay friends with them. Obviously, I'm supplying them with information about models that I'm doing, so it's a two-way street. Then bring it in, test it and measure it in our business and with me, and in, see if it works with what we're doing.
Because people say, you know, the best way to learn is from your mistakes. You're basically saying, no, it's not. Learn from someone else's mistakes. Let them make the mistakes.
I think learning from other people's mistakes is...
cheaper.
is absolutely cheaper and in many ways the key to life.
Yeah.
You know, over the years I've been friends with loads of older guys who you know, have had businesses and, you know, and have kind of done it, and you know, I've got quite a few as my mentors, and you know, I see that, you know, we have a great friendship, but I see that as like a 30-40 year accelerated you know, learning process whereby they've done most of this stuff. They've made most of these big mistakes, and they can give you kind of generic information and principles.
So what would you say to people who challenge that? Oh, like, oh no, you've just got to go out there and do it yourself, make mistakes. You don't need courses and mentors. You just go out there and do it yourself.
Well, you can, but, you know, in many ways, it'll take you a hell of a lot longer, A, and B, you'll end up making a lot more mistakes. You know, if you go along and, I don't know, talk to a lender or talk to a solicitor, or talk to an accountant about how to invest in buy to let. Well, they're going to give you some kind of ideas, but they've not really done it themselves often. Don't know how to do it quickly or the way that makes you the most money. They're probably going to be telling you something that benefits their business and creates the most deals for them or you know, makes them money. So I think it's quite important to learn from those who have actually done it before. You know, you need to walk in their footsteps.
Yeah. This 70-20-10 thing, or your main thing and then other things on the side, I think that's really important in money allocation as well, and asset allocation. And if I look at some of the big things I've seen go wrong over the years from people or businesses, it's often because they're overexposed in one thing. So do you want to talk about that? So, like, you know, you have, well, both of us, property, stocks, watches, bonds, Lego, cash, gold, blah, blah, blah. So would you sort of use the 70-20-10 or 70-25-2-1 similar thinking in terms of where you allocate your money and your assets?
Yeah, so for me, property is the 70 and this business is the 70 and the training business is the 70, but the 20 and the 10 would be things like stocks or bonds or, you know, the maybe watches or those other smaller things that I don't know quite as much about, and I'm not on the ground and involved in quite so much, but I feel like I know enough to enable me to make direct investments.
And if you start putting 1 or 2% of your wealth into a new class, if you make a massive mistake and lose it all, you only lose 1 or 2% of your wealth.
Exactly. And most of the time you wouldn't, as long as you spend long enough learning about it and get the experience over a long period of time as to, you know, what general principles are applicable.
Because it always makes me laugh. You know, you get people coming out saying, oh, you need all your money in gold now.
Oh, yeah.
Or you need all your money in this. I mean, that's surely the dumbest thing ever.
Well, it's just, it's nonsense, isn't it? It's always nonsense.
Yeah.
All your money in anything is a bad idea. You know, if you go and see a financial advisor, that'll be the first thing he does. He'll work out, you know, all of your investment preferences and your attitude to risk and all that sort of stuff. And he'll take you through the FCA kind of approved system to find out where you are in your life and how much risk you want to take on. And then what he'll do, he'll offer you a load of assets which go into, you know, into the markets, which are spread across a load of equities, bonds, and, you know, different asset classes. And that's just the key, the foundations to investment.
So what are your thoughts on focus versus diversification? How much should you focus? How much should you diversify?
Well, I think if you want to make big money, you absolutely need to focus.
Yeah.
And you want to make big money, you need a business usually.
Yeah.
Or, you know, really a great investment strategy like, you know, buying properties and, you know, getting tenants in and remortgaging them. All that stuff that we do. I think that makes you big money. But it is one asset class. You know, property, I think, is relatively secure. Having your own business, I think that is certainly more cyclical and definitely less secure than, say, having some gold or having, you know, maybe some money in a FTSE tracker or something like that. But if you have your own business, you know, the returns that you could get from that could be several hundred, often several thousand percent per annum. You know, that's normal.
Yeah.
You know, people grow a business from a pound, you know, and then, you know, after decades, they may be making millions of pounds. So it's a huge amount of growth. But of course, a recession could come along or there could be other issues and that business could, you know, have a problem. So I think it's very important to spend your 70% on things that are very high growth, but that you really know you're involved in every day, you know, like the back of your hand. And then when you get the money from that, you diversify a lot of that money away into lower risk, but probably lower return asset classes as well, and they're more diversified and spread across those lower risk, lower return asset classes.
Okay, great. So something else you hate is, before I talk about something else you hate, why are we talking about things Mark hates? Because it seems like a random episode. So Mark's just finished his book, Uncommon Sense, and that is the common misconceptions of business, finance and investing and how to profit going against the tide. That's the subtitle. And I think why this book's going to be a game changer, because I was obviously involved in helping you write it in terms of doing the physical typing and helping you get the, you know, I'm not taking any claims, Mark's book.
You were involved rather a lot, weren't you?
Getting
the words out. Yeah.
I think, one, why this book's completely unique and different, and two, why I think it's going to be really big is because it's very contrarian, but it's not like saying, hey, I'm a contrarian. And it's just, there aren't really any books or articles or anything out there which sort of start from the angle of all the misconceptions and all the mistakes and all the kind of wrongs and then getting them out of the way so that you're left with what works. So it's kind of like a positive skeptical or a skeptical positive. I don't really know how to phrase it exactly. Account on what works in business, finance, investing. So that's why we're talking about things that Mark kind of really doesn't like. Just to try and cut, you don't really like fluff, do you? Waffle, BS, media hype. It's not really your thing, is it?
No, it's really not. I mean, you see a lot of the stuff in the media, certainly in the general media, and, you know, they give you ideas on how to invest or, you know, oh, buy-to-let's doing well this month. That's what we've had, I don't know, for the last 3 years or whatever. Or buy-to-let's dead now because of the tax changes or because of these finance changes. It's all so short-term and just based on selling newspapers.
Yeah.
And it's just not, A, it's not reality, and B, it's just bad investment advice. Mm. The motives of most of these publications are just to sell the publication. Fear is
the biggest seller.
It's the biggest seller. You know, you watch the news, most of it is negative, most of it is people dying, or, you know, the reason it's created like that is because it triggers a response in you, which comes right back from, you know,
to survive.
Yeah, survival. You know, we have people hunting, or should I say animals and creatures hunting us, you know, many, many years ago. and genetically we tend to be attracted to that sort of information because we need to know about it, because you know we might need to run away because we're going to be killed by some marauding invader, and it doesn't necessarily serve us in the modern world. So all that negativity on the news, or you know the way in which newspapers all hype things, i.e. something is, you know, when something's really good, it's actually, you know, they make it sound better than it really is, and when something's worse, they make it sound worse than it really is, because that creates interest and draws us in. It's not the reality, and I think most of it can just be ignored. Most of the best investment and kind of business ideas and models come from usually individuals just cracking on. They find a bit of a hole in something, they find something that works, they refine it, and they just keep replicating it. And there's usually a bit of a, you know, a nucleus of people like that who've got good ideas, who share those ideas around and make money from them.
Yeah. Something I feel is really important to be able to do, you and I have had dozens of conversations over the years on this, is when things look bad, you've got to try and find the spin-off opportunity from those things that look bad. And then when things look good, you've got to be careful not to get too pissed on it or unexcited and look at what could go wrong. And I think that's uncommon sense, you know, the sort of the title of your book. And I think that's what contrarianism is. It's, okay, things look bad. What's the opportunity? Okay, it's great. Oh, we're all excited. Okay, so stay calm and look at some of the downsides. So it's that ability to look the opposite to the way the masses are looking at it.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on that?
I think
it a balanced view.
I think that's one of the most important things. Generally, we have this herd mentality. And again, it goes back to genetics and survival of the fittest. If you had, you know, a herd of let's call it people walking along, you know, you're less likely as a member of a group to be attacked individually by, you know, some sort of big animal, or you know, something about to kill you if you're in a big group, rather than if you're on your own. And that's the reason why we look at stories like this, or you know, we behave like lemmings. Mm. You know, we see everybody else do something, and you know, we usually follow on, you know, the same path.
So how do you teach yourself to be the contrarian? How do you teach yourself uncommon sense?
Let me just want to expand on that point. When you go through a cycle, generally the masses get more and more interested in an investment as you get further into the cycle, and certainly towards the end of the cycle, that's when most people interested in doing it.
Mm.
And the reason for that is because as more people do it, more people want to do it.
Mm.
And we all follow along. And of course, most of the juice, most of the profit has already taken place early on in the cycle. So what we really should be doing is looking at what everybody else is doing. And perhaps if everybody else is diving in, maybe we back off.
Yeah.
And when you're right in the middle of a recession, that's probably the time to jump in.
Yeah.
Now, you know, obviously that's quite a simplistic way of looking at it. And there are various points along the cycle where, you know, you're probably just going to put more in at the early parts of the cycle. And then as it comes to the end of the cycle, well, you don't want to just do nothing, but you might switch to income, or you might not be so capital focused, or, you know, you might go into assets that aren't going to drop so much and haven't had such an amazing ride through the cycle and aren't so, they're recession proof. Do you know what I mean? They're not so affected by boom and bust. And, you know, I think it's important to listen to what the mass are doing and kind of say, well, that's where the weight of the money is. That's what they're all doing. And therefore, because the weight of the money has already gone into that asset, because they all think it's great, the gains are already priced in. The price is already you know, already reflects that. It's already reacted.
Mm.
Therefore, anyone who's, you know, looking at a new market and there's not a lot of people there and people are generally negative about it, well, you know, they may think to themselves, you know, if they're a good investor, they may think, well, that's a market where, you know, valuations are very low. People aren't interested in that asset class yet. And therefore, you know, I can pile in, and then when it becomes the norm in the media and, you know, it's great, all that value will then be priced in and you'll have made money.
Yeah.
Now, of course, there is a bit of a caveat to this, because lots of people say to me, oh, I found a market niche, or I found a hole.
Yeah.
You know, I had it said to me earlier on in an interview, I think you guys have found a little rabbit hole here with your business. And you know, of course, you know, I was like, well, thank you very much, absolutely. But it's important to understand that if it's completely new and nobody else is doing it, you should ask yourself, well, you know, is that because that doesn't work? You know, is that because this model is no good and there's no money to be made from it? Sometimes if there's a bit of competition in a market, that means it's a good market and there's money to be made from it. So there are caveats to all of this, and you need to test and measure to work out whether it works for you. You know, the contrarian attitude and, you know, understanding how the media works is great kind of on a superficial level. You know, just giving an idea of what sort of opportunities to start focusing on, because there's so many. And you need to kind of carve out, get rid of all the noise and carve out the things that, you know, you want to actually look at. But then obviously you need to drill deeper. And in the end, you're testing and measuring. You're taking your own preferences and your own discriminatory ideas out of, you know, the investment decision and just putting it all on a spreadsheet and working out over 6 months to 12 months whether the thing works.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about that, because getting to know you over the last 12 odd years, that's something I've found fascinating. I always felt that you were really good at making things black and white and digital and number-based and not emotion-based. And I was the opposite. I was very much an emotional kind of decision-maker. So I want to talk about that in three or four instances. The first is, tell me about your dad, because I know a big part of you being able to remove emotions and make good logical decisions were drilled into you by your dad, who's quite a character. And Mark's first book, Low Cost, High Life, he talks a lot about his dad in that book. So just give us a bit of a flavour for the intricacies and quirks of your dad and how he raised you.
Well, I mean, Dad, you know, Dad was pretty non-conformist. So yeah. He was the ultimate contrarian. And, you know, someone who, you know, if you told him to do something, he'd go and do the opposite.
Is any of that in you?
There's a bit there. But although over the years, I've tried to temper it, because actually, you know, with investing, it can be good as a kind of superficial thing. Yeah. But then obviously you need to dig deeper. That's important. But, you know, with life in general, I find these days it's often better to conform in many ways, because it saves me a lot of time. Yeah. It gets me to my goal quicker.
Yeah. There's no point being a rebel for the sake of being a rebel.
No, and he'd be like that, you know. He'd turn up on a winter's afternoon in town. We'd be in Stamford, where I live now, and he'd walk down the high street in a pair of shorts and a pair of flip flops with his plastic bag, and kind of go in the shops, and everyone would be staring at him, and he'd kind of look back and go, "What's your problem? It's your problem, not mine." obviously he was, you know, he'd been 30 years in the Far East, so that created this within him in many ways, because it was, you know, when you're living in the middle of Africa or you're living in the middle of Indonesia and you're this, you know, this Englishman, when you start exhibiting all these kind of non-conformist ways, well, they don't think it's weird, because they don't know what English people are like anyway. And they just think, oh yeah, you're English. Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
And of course, the more non-conformist he became, the more interesting perhaps he became to many people in those countries, and they probably thought that's what an Englishman did. So, yeah. Of course, 30 odd years of living in that way made him very contrarian.
Yeah.
Now, he wasn't an investor, and he wasn't somebody that made big money. He didn't pay any tax for 30 years because he worked overseas. And when you work overseas...
But you had to save money, didn't you?
You had to save money.
And I think you got a lot of that from him.
Absolutely. So, you know, my dad had, you know, he'd work for 3 years and then he'd have a year off because he'd be on some sort of contract building a road or a big water system or something like that. And, you know, he'd then have a year where he had to save his money because he wouldn't be getting any income. Of course, he'd be paid a lot for those 3 years. So, you know, that really, from a young age, that drilled it into me.
Give us some examples of his real tightness.
Well, I'll never forget, you know, being pulled over by a police officer in Indonesia. And, you know, all the other expatriates, all the other English and Americans, if you get pulled over, you know, you'd be pulled over for not indicating when everybody else is, you know, basically driving through town backwards, you know, doing 80 miles an hour in a 30. And so it's very inconsistent. But they'd see a white face and they kind of go, oh, right, yeah, there's a bit of money. He's not indicated. Let's have him over. So it's all a bit unfair. But, you know, instead of what's right and wrong, and my dad would be like, well, that's wrong. You know, you can't do that to me. you know, most English people would kind of go, well, do you know what? It's 10,000 rupee, it's £3. You just pay him. And that's the end of the matter. And of course, my dad had sit there, and I'll never forget this one time. He spent, you know, I mean, this was like a significant period, like over an hour at the roadside, arguing with this policeman about, you know, his non-indication when he was changing lanes coming up to the, you know, central reservation. You know, and in the end, the police officer who's probably on, I don't know, £4,000 a year, you know, gives up and kind of waves him on because, of course,
so you're just a little kid sitting in the back. Wishing he would shut up.
Yeah, my mum's there, like, really embarrassed. Stuart enough, you know, and all this sort of stuff. And, of course, gets back in the car, that got the little bastard, and then drives off. And,
Pizza Hut, tell us about Pizza Hut.
Yeah, Pizza Hut. We used to go in there, and this had happened most Saturday mornings. We'd, after we'd messed around for most of the morning, we'd get into the local shopping centre. We'd go in for a pizza. Pizza at that time there was, like, £3. Dad would go in, he'd get the salad bar. It was a one-trip salad bar. Yeah. That was the system. He'd go in there and he'd get the salad bowl. And he would basically build the thing up. You know, so he'd put the base in. Because my dad was an engineer. So, yeah. You know.
Put the lettuce wise so he could have more.
And he'd put all the kind of like croutons around there to create a good base. So that he could kind of lift it up right to the top. You know, and I mean, this salad bar thing might have been £1.50 or something like that. But he'd do that so that he only had to go up, you know, one time. And actually, invariably, then he'd go up for a second helping.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of the time, nothing had happened. But every now and again, they put two salad bowls on the bill. And, of course, my dad had just kind of look at it, get him over. And they'd be like, well, this is, you know, you went up twice. And, of course, he'd kind of argue, oh, no, that, you know, this is designed for, you know, fat. You know, kind of whatever people. Do you see what I mean? Who abuse the system? You know, I'm just here having some salad. You know, and he'd argue the point for 20 minutes.
And what did your mum think of it all?
Mum would be really embarrassed. In the early years, I'd be very embarrassed. But actually, as time went on, I used to find it was a bit sadistic, but I used to find it a little bit funny.
Yeah.
Because, of course, it created all this outrage. And I could sit there, watch it all, and I didn't get into any trouble.
Yeah.
Which kind of was quite amusing in some ways. But, of course, it wasn't clever. It wasn't the right thing to do. He'd sit there for 20 minutes, half an hour, arguing over £1.50 when he could have gone and made, you know, £3,000 somewhere else, you know.
Have you ever been a bit like that? Maybe you've spent a bit too much time to
no
save.
Question. Yeah, no question.
Not
and
enough money.
I've had to train myself out of some of those ways.
Yeah.
But, you know, many of them are still within me. Well, you know,
which
where,
you'd want to keep, wouldn't you? Because you don't want it to completely be gone.
No, you know, I'll still be all over the costs and have a bit of a freak out over Christmas, you know, when everything's gone turbo and, you know, Gemma's been in Selfridges buying a load of stuff and, you know, we get home, I suddenly look at my credit card bill and just, right, this has got to stop. We've got to get it all under control again.
Yeah.
So, I still have those moments and I'm still reminded of all that stuff.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's good to be that extreme with it all, but it is, you need to keep an eye on your costs.
Yeah, yeah.
You need to control this stuff because it can easily creep up and it can consume you and you end up with no business.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, every now and again, you just kind of check, don't you? You go back into different areas of the business and you just do a spot check every now and again.
Yeah, I think it's important.
Yeah.
Yeah, you need to go through, you know, everything and kind of say, well, what's the, you know, the credit card machine, what are the bills been for the last six
printers.
Months? What are the printers? What's the stationery costs? What are the insurance costs?
All adds up.
The rent, it does. It, you know, it's important. It's very important.
Critics, trolls, haters. As we've grown, obviously we've, you know, I suppose when we have two customers, we might have two fans. Now I think we've trained 400,000 people, 265,000 on the Progressive database. Nearly 400,000 people on this Disruptive Entrepreneur podcast. Let's just talk openly and randomly and conversationally about critics. What do you think? Do you think that we need them? Do you think that some people take it too far? How do you feel if you ever get critiqued? How do you deal with it emotionally?
Well, I think the first thing to say is, if you don't have critics, you're probably not running a successful business, or you're not really pushing boundaries. Mm. You know, the bigger you get, the more of those you're going to be. You see it with, I don't know, celebrities or big businesses.
Yeah.
They're always going to have these people. So the first thing is they probably keep, in some way, they keep you real. So, yeah. You know, they remind you of your weaknesses, because if you can often surround yourself by yes people,
yeah,
who tell you how good you are, and certainly those in your immediate environment are going to be probably quite positive. But those outside of your immediate sphere are maybe a little bit more honest in some ways. That's the first thing. I think the next thing is you have to look at the motivation behind what the critic is saying. If it's somebody offering you some constructive advice to improve your business or improve the service they're getting, then often you look at it and you think, you know what, I can see why this would be good. Let's make that change. Let's not do that thing anymore to improve the service for our customers. And they should probably be seen in a positive light. I think critics that are using the platform for a means to, A, generate, you know, more interest to their newspaper or their forum or their Facebook group or whatever it is, I think once you understand that that's their agenda, they're trying to say this stuff to get attention. Remember, negative news stories sell, get the attention, get people looking, and you know that creates the most traffic. Well, if they're then monetizing that on the back end, i.e. they're getting advertising or they're selling services and deal packages, whatever it is they're selling off the back of that, well, I think, you know, that's a little bit more, you know, you probably wouldn't want to take that as seriously, you know, because you know, they've clearly got an agenda, there's an ulterior motive there, and they're not necessarily doing it for the good of customers or the good of your business.
Yeah.
They're doing it to generate money from their business.
Yeah.
So I think the motivation and the agenda of the person doing it is important.
Mm.
You know, another type of critic might be one that just goes on and hates, like a troll.
Mm.
You know, maybe their life isn't running very well themselves. They're not very successful. They feel very jealous, you know, and often they hide behind this, you know, computer or another profile or whatever, pull a load of negative stuff up about you or your business. And that gives them some sort of feeling of power,
yeah,
makes them feel good about themselves, which makes up for, you know, their inability to make a success out of their life or their business or whatever. So I think constructive feedback and criticism...
Yeah, I think you've got to know the difference, haven't you?
Yeah, you have. Yeah. I think when it's constructive, you know, and when it's protecting people, you know, sometimes there are scams or, you know, there are things that happen, certainly in our space, that do lose people a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I think when, you know, it's exposing things like that, where there is a genuine... you know, a genuine kind of risk to consumers and people investing, I think it can be beneficial obviously for the consumer and beneficial to all the other businesses doing, you know, good honest business.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to understand that there are different types of critics, different types of haters or feedback, understand what their agenda is, and then either ignore it, take action against it, or you know, maybe change your business if what they're saying is for the right reason and they've got a point.
Yeah. So emotional mastery or emotional development, something we talk about a lot. One of the things I really believe will grow your business the most is managing your emotions. And, you know, you and I have done things in the past a bit emotionally, me probably more than you, to be fair, but we've got some funny stories. I remember you pointing in someone's face and dropping a few bombs on him. And I've certainly flipped out at people. And, we all, if you speak to anyone who's really successful, they all say, the bigger you get, the more critics you'll get, you need them. So it's kind of, anyone who's studied any successful people, they know that. But you take every one of those successful people, it still pisses them off and upsets them, doesn't it? It still gets to them.
Yeah.
So how do we develop this emotional mastery, if you like, where there's a difference between us just saying, hey, I need more critics because I'm growing, and actually, when you feel the emotion, controlling it. How do you control your emotions?
Well, A, you don't always have to, you know, if there's a lot of critical stuff coming from one direction and it's not, you know, you've looked at it and it's not, you know, there's no basis to it, or it's not fair, or it's not being done for the right reasons, you can just block it out.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily have to listen to it.
Mm.
You don't have to read it. So that could be one way. The next way, I think, is to have those around you who support you and are actually interested in your success and your business's success. Get them to tell you what they honestly think.
Yeah.
You know, that's a good, you know, say to them, well, is this true? Do you think, you know, and if it is true, please, can you tell me, just be honest, you know, and have an impartial person who, you know, is interested in your success tell you, and not just a yes person. I think that's quite important. Something I do, you just got to release stress and you've got to generally make yourself, you know, feel good about yourself and the day. If I exercise in the morning and I eat properly and I sleep well, I can deal with all that sort of stuff a lot better than if I don't do one of the three of those things. It's weird how much those three things mean to my life. You know, having good amount of sleep, good amount of exercise in the morning, and eating properly, I can almost deal with anything.
And I'd add one thing to that, and I've really valued that in our relationship over the last 12, 15 years, whatever. When did we actually meet? We met December 05, didn't we? So that's 12 years. Is having someone to talk to that you value their opinion. Oh. Even, you know, because sometimes...
A business partner who is invested in the thing in the way that you are.
Yeah, and understands.
Understands. That's really important. And the other thing is, the downside will hurt them as much as it will hurt you, because...
So A, feeling that you're not alone.
Yeah, that's important. A, feeling you're not alone. And B, if you've got someone there who is invested in it and has as much upside and downside as you, then your, you know, their opinion is going to be probably a lot more valid. Yeah.
And also it gives you the release, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because normally... Your initial reaction, wired into us, hardwired into human beings, is to react.
Yeah.
You know, on a keyboard warrior, for example, or defensive. Some people get angry. Some people spit out. Some people take it all inside and it hurts their esteem. You know, we all react differently. But if you can talk to someone about it, that's the release. And then you probably deal with it a lot better publicly or whatever. So we could literally go on for ages. I've got here, we wanted to talk about capitalism, money, creating more happiness. We wanted to talk about scalable businesses, proven business models. So we're probably going to have to do a part two. I don't want to keep Mark because he's got to go and do quite an important valuation. But Mark's new book, Uncommon Sense, is very exciting. This literally launches, if you're listening to this on the first day that it's live, today. So you need to go to Amazon and get yourself a copy. Now, Mark's got a couple of special deals going on. So if you get just one copy of Uncommon Sense, which you can find on Amazon, then you get two tickets to the Business Lifestyle Summit. We've got quite a lot of big name celebrity speakers coming to that 2-day event where you can basically learn how to build a leveraged business that will make you a handsome profit, but also merge with the lifestyle that you want to create. Mark will be doing a keynote speech on that, as well as some big names. I'll probably be along to do a keynote slot on the lifestyle side of it too. So you get that just for getting one book. Now, by the way, that's until the Business Lifestyle Summit tickets sell out. So you'll have to be very quick for that, because we normally only have 200 at an event and we're only doing, I think, two of them. So the next offer we've got is if you buy 5 copies of Mark's book, Uncommon Sense, then he's going to do a private roundtable mastermind for you. So again, this is probably limited to about 75 or 80 people, but go and get 5 copies and you'll be able to come to our training facility. And Mark will sit on a sofa, and for 75 or 8 of you, you'll be in the room and you'll get 4 hours being able to do one-to-ones questions with him. So we could call it a roundtable mastermind. And it's not very often Mark does these things, so you should definitely take him up on that. And you can come along with as many questions as you like. I think that's a really great thing that Mark's offering to do to donate his time. That's if you get 5 books of Uncommon Sense, Low Cost, High Love. That's his first book. And also you get put into a draw. Mark's booked a table at the Fat Duck. That's a 3-star Michelin restaurant. I'll be going because I'd never miss a good opportunity for a good dinner. And we're going to take another 2 people along, so you get put into a draw for that. And then finally, if you get 7 copies of Uncommon Sense, he'll give you a 15-minute one-to-one. So literally on the phone, 15 minutes with him. Now, if you want the round table and the draw and the 15-minute one-to-one, you need to buy 5, and then you need to buy 7. So that's 12. So I know it's kind of a bit complicated, but we just wanted to give you some great gifts for being a supporter of The Disruptive Entrepreneur and a supporter of Mark My Words and a supporter of Progressive Property over the years. This is the 10th anniversary of our business. This is the 12th anniversary of our partnership. So we wanted to sort of give back and thank you. And hey, it's not my time, it's his, so I can kind of do that. So let me just summarize. Today, Uncommon Sense went live. So no more is it a pre-order. It's now live. Get it. one copy and you get two tickets to the Business Lifestyle Summit. You've got to be quick, first 400. Five copies and you get the Roundtable Mastermind with Mark personally in the same room as him. But that's first, I think, 70, 75. And you get put in a draw to have dinner with us at the Fat Duck. And then seven copies and you get to have a 15-minute one-to-one phone call with him. I don't know how many he's doing of them, probably about 30, 35. So it's kind of first come, first serve on that as well. If you want all of that, you need to buy five and seven, because one counts anyway. So you need to buy 12. And in any of our communities, Progressive Property, Mark My Words, Disruptive Entrepreneur, just message us, let us know that you've got, send us a screenshot and we'll make sure you get hooked up to all those bonuses. So thanks for tuning in to special double edition of the Disruptive Entrepreneur. And Mark My Words, and I want to say thanks to Mark Homer. What a great privilege it is. He only writes a book every kind of 5 years or so, very rarely in the public eye, because he likes going off and doing big property deals. That's why he's gone off now to do his big valuation. So thanks, Mark, and thanks for tuning in. And remember, if you don't risk anything, you risk everything.